She knocked on my door after 6 years gone, said she was my daughter. Same eyes, same smirk, same voice that used to whisper, "I love you, Daddy," before bedtime. But something was off. Too perfect, too polished. She made saffron tea and said it vibrated at the frequency of forgiveness. Then the dream started, then the bank calls. Then my real daughter, the one I buried in my grief, left me a voicemail saying, "That's not me, Dad. That's not Claire." What followed wasn't just manipulation. It was engineered. A cult. A system. A ritual of identity theft so precise, it made me forget my own memories. They didn't just steal my life. They erased the world's memory of her existence. And now they're training the next one. Her name was never Claire. And I was never meant to survive her. Subscribe now. Because the next voice you trust might be the one that rewrites your entire life. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform now, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. You never really expect ghosts to knock. Not in a town like this. Everything in Wilford Heights is too clean, too curated. The lawns hum with automatic sprinklers. The air smells like lavender and money. Even the birds sound like they've been trained to chirp in key. Grief isn't supposed to live here. But mine did. Quietly. In the master bedroom. Right next to the antique clock I haven't wound in 6 years. Since the day Claire left. Not died, left. Ran. Vanished. After the divorce. 1 minute she was 13 and drawing horses on the kitchen counter. And the next, a runaway with a burner phone and a gap in her story. The cops called it self-emancipation. Said she'd resurface when she was ready. I never was. It was a Thursday. I remember because the maid comes on Fridays, and the house still smelled like empty whiskey and regret. The envelope was cream-colored, textured thick. It had that old-world kind of paper weight, the kind you'd expect to come with a will or a wedding invitation. But there was no name on it. Just Dad, written in a hand I recognized and didn't. Inside was a letter. 3 lines. "Daddy, I'm ready to come home. I know you miss me. I forgive you. Meet me. 3 p.m., North Haven bus station. This Friday." That was it. No return address. No phone number. No apology. Just a single postscript, scratched in rushed ink. "Please don't bring anyone else." The bus station smelled like wet metal and lost chances. I hadn't been there in over a decade. Back when Claire's mother still wore heels and called me David, like it meant something. Before she traded us both for a life coach named Blake and a Tesla with ethical leadership plates. The station hadn't changed. Still gray. Still graffiti tagged. Still echoing with the hum of late arrivals. I stood by the vending machine, heart racing, palms sweating through 1,000 worst case scenarios. What if it wasn't her? What if it was a setup? What if she hated me? And then, she stepped off the bus. She was taller, thinner, more composed. She walked like she owned time, like the seconds bowed to her stride. "Hi, Dad," she said. And just like that, my body forgot how to stand. The voice was soft, calm, almost too calm, like a therapist whispering through a fog of sedatives. Her eyes were the same, though. Same stormy blue with the flecks of gray around the iris. Same way she tilted her chin up when she wanted to look grown. Same damn smirk. But everything else was wrong. Or maybe too right. She hugged me. Slow. Deliberate. Like she was reading my body language mid-embrace. I felt her fingers press into the top of my spine, firm, intentional, like she was searching for something. Then she pulled back and said the thing that made my gut twist. "You don't need to say anything. You're still in pain. That's okay. I'm here to heal you now." We drove back in silence. She looked out the window the whole time like she was studying the trees for secrets. When we pulled into the driveway, she smiled. "This is exactly how I remembered it," she said. I didn't have the heart to tell her I'd gutted the place 4 years ago. Inside, she asked to see her old room. I led her up the stairs and unlocked the door I hadn't opened in years. Her posters were gone. So were the books. All that remained was a single broken lamp and a stuffed horse missing an eye. She picked up the toy like it was sacred. "I thought you'd have changed everything," she whispered. I opened my mouth to respond, but she turned before I could. "I want to make dinner. Just us. Like old times." She moved like she already knew where everything was. The pans. The spices. Even the pressure cooker she'd only ever seen once years ago. She asked if I still liked saffron rice. I nodded before I even remembered if I did. As she stirred the pot, she said something odd. Did you know saffron vibrates at 384 megahertz? It's the frequency of forgiveness. I chuckled, unsure if it was a joke. She didn't laugh. That night, I stood outside her bedroom door long after she fell asleep. I don't know why. Maybe to be sure she was real. Maybe to make sure she wouldn't vanish again. I pressed my ear to the door. She was humming. Softly. The tune was unfamiliar. But the rhythm, it made my skin crawl. It was measured. Controlled. Like she wasn't just singing, she was calibrating. The next morning, my phone rang. Blocked number. A voice. Weak. Static-filled. Dad, it's me. It's Claire. You never really expect ghosts to knock. Not in a town like this. Everything in Wilford Heights is too clean. Too curated. The lawns hum with automatic sprinklers. The air smells like lavender and money. Even the birds sound like they've been trained to chirp and key. Grief isn't supposed to live here. But mine did. Quietly. In the master bedroom. Right next to the antique clock I haven't wound in 6 years. Since the day Claire left. Not died, left. Ran. Vanished. After the divorce. 1 minute she was 13 and drawing horses on the kitchen counter. And the next, a runaway with a burner phone and a gap in her story. The cops called it self-emancipation. Said she'd resurface when she was ready. I never was. It was a Thursday. I remember because the maid comes on Fridays, and the house still smelled like empty whiskey and regret. The envelope was cream-colored, textured thick. It had that old-world kind of paper weight, the kind you'd expect to come with a will or a wedding invitation. But there was no name on it. Just Dad, written in a hand I recognized and didn't. Inside was a letter. 3 lines. Daddy, I'm ready to come home. I know you miss me. I forgive you. Meet me. 3 p.m., North Haven bus station. This Friday. That was it. No return address. No phone number. No apology. Just a single postscript, scratched in rushed ink. Please don't bring anyone else. The bus station smelled like wet metal and lost chances. I hadn't been there in over a decade. Back when Claire's mother still wore heels and called me David, like it meant something. Before she traded us both for a life coach named Blake and a Tesla with ethical leadership plates. The station hadn't changed. Still gray. Still graffiti tagged. Still echoing with the hum of late arrivals. I stood by the vending machine. Heart racing. Palms sweating through 1,000 worst case scenarios. What if it wasn't her? What if it was a setup? What if she hated me? And then, she stepped off the bus. She was taller. Thinner. More composed. She walked like she owned time, like the seconds bowed to her stride. Hi, Dad, she said. And just like that, my body forgot how to stand. The voice was soft. Calm. Almost too calm, like a therapist whispering through a fog of sedatives. Her eyes were the same, though. Same stormy blue with the flecks of gray around the iris. Same way she tilted her chin up when she wanted to look grown. Same damn smirk. But everything else was wrong. Or maybe too right. She hugged me. Slow. Deliberate. Like she was reading my body language mid-embrace. I felt her fingers press into the top of my spine, firm, intentional, like she was searching for something. Then she pulled back and said the thing that made my gut twist. You don't need to say anything. You're still in pain. That's okay. I'm here to heal you now. We drove back in silence. She looked out the window the whole time like she was studying the trees for secrets. When we pulled into the driveway, she smiled. This is exactly how I remembered it, she said. I didn't have the heart to tell her I'd gutted the place 4 years ago. Inside, she asked to see her old room. I led her up the stairs and unlocked the door I hadn't opened in years. Her posters were gone. So were the books. All that remained was a single broken lamp and a stuffed horse missing an eye. She picked up the toy like it was sacred. I thought you'd have changed everything, she whispered. I opened my mouth to respond, but she turned before I could. I want to make dinner. Just us. Like old times. She moved like she already knew where everything was. The pans. The spices. Even the pressure cooker she'd only ever seen once years ago. She asked if I still liked saffron rice. I nodded before I even remembered if I did. As she stirred the pot, she said something odd. Did you know saffron vibrates at 384 megahertz? It's the frequency of forgiveness. I chuckled, unsure if it was a joke. She didn't laugh. That night, I stood outside her bedroom door long after she fell asleep. I don't know why. Maybe to be sure she was real. Maybe to make sure she wouldn't vanish again. I pressed my ear to the door. She was humming, softly. The tune was unfamiliar, but the rhythm, it made my skin crawl. It was measured, controlled. Like she wasn't just singing, she was calibrating. The next morning, my phone rang. Blocked number. A voice. Weak. Static-filled. Dad, it's me. It's Claire. There's something wrong with the mirrors in this house. They don't just reflect, they watch. I've lived here for over a decade, and never once noticed how the hallway mirror tilts slightly downward, or how the reflection from the living room warps just enough to make my smile look crooked. But since she arrived, the house feels like it's leaning inward, like every window, every object, is in on something I'm not. And I swear, I can hear her humming even when she's not home. She started preparing ritual meals. Nothing heavy, always light, fragrant. Figs, goat cheese, fermented lemon water, saffron tea, always saffron, always in the same clay mug with a chipped side. She insisted I drink it after every meal. Said it aligned my blood intelligence. I laughed the first time she said that. She didn't. The body keeps secrets your mind's been programmed to reject, she told me. That tea? It opens the lock. I should have thrown it out. But I didn't. I drank it. And the dream started. Not nightmares. Just loops. Memories I hadn't thought of in years, playing over and over. Claire's first ballet recital. Claire asleep on my chest. Claire whispering, "Don't let mommy leave." Only it wasn't Claire. Not quite. The face was slightly off. The voice just a little too smooth. Too trained. Like someone was puppeting my memories from behind a screen. 3 days into the tea, I stopped recognizing myself in photos. My reflection looked hollowed out. I knew it was me, but he blinked too slow, smiled too long. And the girl who claimed to be Claire? She started calling me David. Not Dad. Not Daddy. Just David. One night, I followed her into the basement. She said she was reorganizing old storage boxes. But when I crept down the stairs, I found her kneeling in front of a black box the size of a microwave, covered in velvet cloth. She had headphones on. The same low hum played, a binaural rhythm, just above hearing level, peppered with strange reversed phrases. The screen on the device flashed symbols, spirals, alchemical glyphs, coordinates. And one word pulsed red every few seconds. Recalibrating. I bumped a mop handle and she turned, too fast. Her face was blank for a half second. Not shocked. Not angry. Just blank. Like something had to switch on before she remembered how to emote. David, she said, rising smoothly. You really shouldn't be down here. Not yet. I tried to play it cool. Old habits. Wanted to check the fuse box. She smiled. Too wide. You always were curious. That's why you were chosen. Chosen for what? She stepped closer, brushing her hand down my forearm, her voice soft enough to feel like silk. To be unmade. I confronted her the next morning. Who are you really? She sat cross-legged in the sunroom, eyes closed, incense curling around her. I'm your daughter, David. You're not. She opened one eye. I'm who you needed her to become. Then she said it, the sentence that would haunt me for weeks. Claire broke too soon, but I'm better. I can carry more weight. I'm here to finish the healing that she failed to survive. I lost it. I grabbed her shoulders. What the hell are you talking about? What do you mean she didn't survive? Where is Claire? She didn't flinch. Didn't move. You've already begun the purge. That anger? That's old software dying. And then she whispered something that made my stomach flip. We had to erase her, David. She wasn't strong enough for phase 3. I called the police. Finally. Gave them the whole thing. The letter, the photo, the fake ID I found in her bag, under the name Mira Langston. The strange audio files. They sent 2 officers. They interviewed her calmly in the kitchen while I paced in the hallway. An hour later, they told me there was no crime. That she had my permission to stay. That she seemed mentally sound. That I sounded confused. You've had a lot of stress recently, sir. Maybe take a few days off work. Regroup. And when they left, she walked to the door. Waved sweetly at them. Closed it gently. Then turned to me and said, Phase 2 is complete. Your resistance is nearly extinguished. But don't worry. We'll leave a memory of love behind. That night, I tried to lock her out of the bedroom. She didn't try the handle. She just stood outside the door, whispering low, rhythmic things through the wood. I recorded some of it. Played it back. The audio came through as silence. Then static. then a single voice, my own, saying, "I trust you, Mira. I trust you, Mira. I trust you, Mira," over and over. I dropped the phone. My knees gave out. Somewhere in the dark, I could hear her humming again. I started keeping notes. In a locked drawer, under a false bottom. Dates. Times. Behavior patterns. Phrases she repeated. Tones she used. The food she served. The audio frequencies I could barely hear, but somehow felt. Because something was happening to me. My thoughts were curated. My reactions slowed. My instincts blunted. At times, I'd find myself standing in front of the refrigerator and not knowing why, or staring at my laptop, unable to remember what I was about to do. The woman in my house was reprogramming me, not like a therapist, like a developer. It started with the passwords. My work laptop locked me out. Then my phone glitched. Then came the call from Fidelity. "Sir, just confirming your decision to transfer all your retirement funds into the offshore LLC you created last week." I never made that transfer, but someone using my VoiceSprint did. She watched me spiral, smiling through herbal teas and lavender compresses. "You're resisting integration," she whispered. "That's normal. What are you doing to me?" She didn't blink. "It's not what I'm doing. It's what I've been trained to unlock. We only erase what no longer serves." That night, I followed her again. She left the house at midnight, took the Lexus I forgot I had. I tailed her through backroads I didn't recognize, past warehouses and industrial strips, into a gated complex with no sign, no guard. She keyed herself in. I waited 40 minutes. Then I broke in through the side lot. What I saw chilled my blood. It wasn't a wellness center. It was a lab. Servers lined the walls. Cables like arteries. A glowing core in the center. What looked like a temperature-controlled archive system labeled Emotion Mapping Module, version 12.9. I crept deeper, watched from behind a glass wall. A group of them, women aged maybe 18 to 25, stood around a large touchscreen, reviewing emotional profiles. Names, ages, biometric stats. Each profile had tags. Market emotion, male authority trauma. Celestial insight, grief slash abandonment. Influence style, NLP cultivation slash erotic neutral. There was a folder named after me. I copied what I could, took photos, videos, voice memos. Before I left, I passed a room with a frosted glass door. A figure sat inside, tall, motionless, hands folded. Female. A brass plaque read, "Mistress of Introspection, Level 9. She looked straight through the glass and smiled. I ran. The next morning, I checked my bank account. Zero. My emails locked out. Socials hacked. Home security, offline. On my nightstand sat a neatly folded note. "Welcome to the shadows of justice. We don't steal. We collect what was always borrowed. You were never the man she needed. But now, you are finally empty enough to be reshaped." I called the police again. No one answered. Not even dispatch. I drove to the station. A different officer. Different tone. "Sir, you've already filed a mental health crisis form. There's nothing else to report." I didn't file anything. He pulled it up on screen. There it was, my name, signature, psych history. But none of it was real. She had created a false psychiatric profile for me, and the department believed it. "You're not in danger," he said, handing me a pamphlet. "You're just overwhelmed. You should consider a stay at Wilton Recovery." She had pre-written my breakdown. I returned home in a panic. She was on the porch, sitting still, waiting. "You followed me," she said. I said nothing. "You saw the room?" Silence. She nodded. "It's time for phase 3. We'll begin extraction next. Don't worry, you won't feel it until the memories start fading." I ran inside, locked the doors, barricaded the bedroom, pored over everything I had written, pages of notes, timelines, photos. And then I saw it, a line I had written, in my own handwriting. "The saffron disrupts short-term recall. She warned me not to overconsume it. That's when the fractures begin." I had no memory of writing it. That night, I dreamt in code. Strings of language. Spirals of sound. And at the end of the dream, she whispered, "You're not losing yourself, David. You're becoming someone worth inhabiting. The mind doesn't break cleanly. It drips. A slow unraveling. First your memory misplaces things. Then your instincts go quiet. And finally, your own voice starts to sound like someone else's." I'd stopped trusting my thoughts days ago. But my phone rang at 3:14 a.m. No name. No number. And the voice on the other end? Not Mira. Not the daughter. It was Claire, the real one. "Dad, listen to me. Don't speak. Just listen." Her voice trembled like it was being filtered through 1,000 miles of wire and fear. "You're not crazy. That woman in your house, she's not me. She's part of a group. They watch. They record. They live inside your grief like it's a second skin. You have to leave. Now." I sat up. My pulse thrashed. "Where are you?" I asked. "Safe. For now. But if you talk to anyone, if you confront her, they'll end it early. That's what happened to the others." "Others?" The line crackled. Then she said something that flipped my stomach inside out. "I didn't run away, Dad. I was taken. They tried to make me into what she is. But I failed the final phase." Before I could ask more, the call dropped. I stared at the phone like it had exploded in my hand. Outside, the porch light flicked on. She was awake, standing in the yard, barefoot, in the rain, smiling at nothing, like she had heard the call, with no phone, no earpiece, just her intuition. I stayed up, watched her pace under the streetlight. She whispered to herself in fragments. Numbers, phrases, code, mirror protocol initiated, subject resisting phase 4, real daughter leak probability 12%. That wasn't a daughter. That was a handler. The next morning, I acted normal. Oatmeal. Tea. Blank smiles. She noticed the shift. Tilted her head slightly as we sat on the porch. "You're quieter today, David." I sipped the tea but didn't swallow. "Just tired." She nodded and reached out, placing her hand over mine. "You're progressing beautifully. They'll be pleased." "Who's they?" She blinked. Slowly. Like a cat measuring prey. "The council. The ones who chart emotional markets. They chose you because you held grief too long, like gold under your tongue." I made excuses to leave. Went to a motel 2 towns over. Pulled up everything I could find. Ascent Institute. Mirror Doctrine. Mistress of Introspection. Dark web forums. Abandoned subreddits. Deleted news articles. Then I found it, an old conspiracy podcast from 2019. The host was holed up in a trailer in Montana. Claimed his daughter was replaced after a yoga retreat. Called it society manipulation via engineered daughters. I laughed out loud, until he said the words. "They always start with saffron, then they play binaural beats, then they convince you to self-report your own instability. Once they've harvested your identity, they vanish." I rushed home, tore through her room, found the burner phone, hidden inside the lining of a makeup case. It had a single audio file. "David, integration complete. Your grief levels have normalized. Emotional soft spots converted into ethical obedience. Transfer will be executed by dawn. Do not resist. Love, Mira." Then the front door creaked open. She was standing there. Calm. But not Mira. Someone else. Same face. Different eyes. More alert. Less polished. "You shouldn't have found that," she said. "You're not her," I whispered. "I was. Until you interfered. Now we have to expedite extraction." I lunged for the phone. She blocked me. Fast. Too fast. Like she'd been trained. Like this wasn't the first time. She pinned my arm with surgical precision. Her eyes wide and void. "You were chosen because of your predictable decay curve, David. Your love for Claire was always going to make you vulnerable." I broke free. Grabbed the fireplace poker. "You took my daughter." She didn't move. "No. You gave her away the moment you chose yourself. We just finished what your guilt started." Sirens in the distance. Not for her. For me. She had already filed the emergency order. Staged the bruises. Made the call. I was the madman. She was the frightened daughter. And as I backed away, she smiled. "We'll leave soon. But your architecture will remain. We'll use it to train the next one." I ran. Not because I believed I'd escape. But because I had to hold on to something that was mine before it was rewritten. And as I passed the hallway mirror, I saw her reflection blink back at me. Even though she wasn't standing there. There's a moment where fear becomes so loud, it collapses into silence. That's where I lived now. In the days that followed, I moved like a ghost, shifting from motels to parking garages, hiding in plain sight. I didn't sleep. I didn't eat much. My thoughts were constantly calculating, spinning, mind racing from one unfinished conclusion to another. I knew I had to find them. Not just Mira, the others. The ones behind the spiral. The saffron. The gaslighting. The emotional engineering. Because if I didn't, I knew I'd end up like the man I used to be. Erased. Perfectly. Quietly. permanently. I started with the burner phone. Deep in the settings, buried under developer tools, was a hidden app called Living Mirror. No icon, no interface, just a blank screen and a single word, a line. When I tapped it, the screen flashed. Then a message appeared. Welcome, initiate. Emotional terrain map, access granted. And then coordinates. I drove for hours, past the city, into the woods, toward a lakeside retreat once owned by a wellness influencer who disappeared during a cleanse. There it was, a brutalist dome of glass and concrete, rising like a temple out of the forest. No signage, no gate, just a single emblem etched into the steel door, a gold spiral inside a mirror frame. The moment I stepped inside, I felt it. The pressure, the control, like the air had weight, like the building was thinking. Inside, a woman in a charcoal robe greeted me without expression. She didn't ask my name, just whispered, "He has arrived. Begin inner ring protocol." They knew I was coming, and they didn't care. I was led down a hallway of smoked glass and LED-lit floors, each step illuminating a new phrase carved into the walls. Emotion is currency. Grief is architecture. Daughters are delivery systems. Love is the Trojan horse. They brought me into a room called the Archive Gallery. It wasn't a gallery. It was a server room, towering racks of drives. Screens playing split-second clips of men, fathers, screaming, crying, begging. Footage captured from inside homes. Bedrooms. Offices. I saw myself, sobbing in the kitchen, asking Mira what I did wrong. They had been recording me for weeks, maybe months, maybe longer. Then she entered, the woman from the frosted glass room, tall, bald, clothed in deep red, a single white spiral painted over her left eye. She didn't speak right away. She circled me like a vulture. "You were a high-value subject," she said softly. "Our first Tier 3 masculine identity anchor in years. Where's my daughter?" She smiled. Claire couldn't carry the imprint. Her grief ceiling was too high. Her emotional output too raw. She collapsed under the weight of your remorse. I stepped forward. My voice cracked. "Did you kill her?" "No." She leaned in close. "You did. The moment you stopped looking for her. That's when we knew we could install Mira." I lunged. Fists, rage, pain. All of it useless. Two men restrained me. Injected something. My vision blurred. As I slumped to the floor, the mistress whispered, "You see grief as a tragedy. We see it as infrastructure. And from it, we build obedience." I woke up in a room made of mirrors. No bed. No chair. Just a floor and mirrored walls. My reflection stared back, but not in sync. It was delayed. Off. Then it began to move on its own. It opened its mouth and said, "You were never the father. Just the framework." I screamed. Punched the glass. My hand shattered before the mirror did. A speaker clicked on. Myra's voice poured into the room. "You're doing beautifully, David. All that pain, it's finally useful." I don't know how long I was in that room. 3 days. 10. The lights never changed. The meals were slipped through a seam in the wall. Every hour, new audio played. "You are not your failures." Claire chose the exit. Emotion is to be optimized, not indulged. Eventually, they let me out. No restraints. No force. They led me to a room called the Unfolding Chamber. Inside was a long table. Screens. Contracts. Biometric scanners. "You will transfer your remaining assets," said the mistress. "And in return, you'll receive serenity. And if I don't, you already have. The process began when you drank the tea." I signed. Not because I agreed, but because I knew they weren't done. Not with me. Not with the next man. Not with the next Claire. They were building something bigger. Something that moved through society manipulation like a silent epidemic. And I had to survive long enough to expose it. I came home. Not because it was over, but because I needed a battleground I recognized. And because I knew what they were going to do next. Erase me completely. You don't just walk away from the mirror doctrine. You return branded. Like a defective prototype with corrupted firmware. They left me with nothing. No money. No credentials. No daughter. Just the memory of being hollowed out by influence psychology and cognitive manipulation dressed as healing. And Mira? She was gone. Vanished like vapor. But the house still smelled like her. Lavender. Saffron. Blood truth. I walked room to room, but it wasn't mine anymore. There were shifts, tiny ones. The mirrors now faced slightly different angles. The rugs were a half inch off. and the refrigerator played a low hum that pulsed in triplets, like a synthetic heartbeat. I turned off the breaker. The sound kept playing. That's when I knew the truth. They never left. That night, the whispers began. Not voices. Not hallucinations. Audio files. Laced into the structure of the house itself. Hidden in the vents. The floors. The pipes. Subject still exhibits resistance. Recalibration advisable. Begin second cycle exposure. I searched the crawl space. Found a black box the size of a hard drive. No markings except a single spiral scratched into the casing. I smashed it. The hum stopped. For 2 hours. Then came back, louder. The next day, HR called from my old firm. David, we received some disturbing footage. You with a young woman, appearing unstable, violent. We've had to report it. Effective immediately, your partnership has been terminated. I never sent footage. But someone did. They had used the same security cameras I'd installed for safety. Twisted them. Recut the timeline. Spliced my outbursts. Added her recoiling, artificially enhanced. Audio manipulation at its finest. You've become a reputational liability, they said. And just like that, 15 years of trust gone. Then came the emails. Photos. Videos. Of Claire. Some real. Some doctored. One of her in a medical gown, eyes vacant, next to a woman with no face. Another of her being led into a building marked Echelon 9, cognitive realignment. There were GPS pings. Hospital records. Fake diagnoses. A paper trail of her instability. They weren't just erasing me. They were rewriting her, too. I drove 4 hours north to the address buried in the metadata. Found a farmhouse converted into a compound. Faded sign. Ascend through grief. A man met me at the gate. Polite. Smiling. Too polished. Here for your daughter's integration ceremony. My mouth went dry. Claire. He smiled wider. Formerly. She's Mira now. Would you like a front row seat? I backed away. Drove off. I knew I wasn't getting her that night. Not from that place. Not without a war. But I recorded everything. Marked coordinates. Noted faces. License plates. Even the celestial calendar posted on the wall with the phrase. Grief peaks at lunar perigee. Harvest during emotional low tide. These weren't just manipulators. They were emotional engineers. When I got home, the front door was open. The mirrors had been turned inward. Every reflection showed me looking in the wrong direction. On my bed was a gift box. Inside, a child's drawing. One I recognized. Claire's. From when she was 9. Only it was altered. She had drawn herself and me. But my face had been replaced. Scribbled out. And underneath, in perfect penmanship. I remember who you were. But I prefer who they made me. I fell asleep with the drawing in my hand. And sometime in the early morning, I heard it again, her voice. Whispering through the walls. Don't fight it, David. They need someone to model grief again. You're still useful. You don't realize how fragile reality is until you hear your own bank tell you that you no longer exist. It started with a simple call. Hello, Mr. Langston. Just confirming your authentication. You've successfully completed the full asset migration to Mira Holdings LTD, Grand Cayman Branch. I didn't speak. Couldn't. The rep continued, pleasantly robotic. All remaining funds and property deeds have been transferred under the fiduciary supervision of your legal heir and caretaker, Mira Langston. Per the recorded audio file, this transaction is final and irreversible under international code. Heir. Caretaker. Final. They had taken everything. My pension. My investments. The house. Even my identity. The name David Langston now sat under guardian override. And the signature on file? It was mine. Only I had no memory of signing it. I drove to the bank in person. Demanded to see a manager. Explained the situation. Identity theft, manipulation, fraud. They pulled the footage. There I was. Smiling. Calm. Signing the transfer papers with Mira beside me. Only I knew that wasn't me. It was a simulation. Either deepfake. Or some controlled recording session they orchestrated during one of my blackout states. You were clear and sound, sir, the manager said. We had multiple biometric confirmations. How did I even pass the security questions? She hesitated. You answered, unusually fast. Almost like you anticipated the questions before we asked them. Behavioral psychology. NLP techniques. Response priming. They hadn't just stolen my identity. They'd engineered my consent. I drove home in a daze. The lights in the house were already off. The furniture gone. Walls stripped. Rugs lifted. Shelves empty. And written on the living room wall in lipstick. Grief is payment. Silence is peace. I dropped to my knees. My hands trembled. My chest caved in. This wasn't manipulation anymore. This was ritualized erasure. That night, I sat on the kitchen floor with the last cup of saffron tea I'd ever touch. I analyzed it. Literally. Drove it to a private lab 3 towns over. Offered $1,000 cash for rush toxicology. 2 hours later, the tech handed me the report, confused. There's no poison, but we found microdoses of psilocybin. Also traces of an unlisted synthetic compound, no registry. But it shows similar receptor effects to suggestibility enhancers. So a truth serum? He shook his head. Worse. It doesn't make you tell the truth. It makes you believe whatever someone else defines as truth. I returned to the motel. Burned the last tea bag. Shut off every device. Wrote a full report. All my notes. All the audio clips. Video. Timeline. Organizational structure. And I sent it. To everyone. Newsrooms. Anonymous forums. Reddit. Telegram channels. Twitter burner accounts. Even a few influencers I knew were conspiracy junkies. I called it the Daughter Program, inside the cult that harvests grief for profit. The next day, I woke to a letter under my door. No return address. No name. Just one page, handwritten. You've done your part beautifully, David. They'll need new fear. New grief. You've taught them how to scale it. Then a postscript. Claire remembers everything. But she chose them. We all do, eventually. I vomited in the sink. Then I opened the motel room closet and saw what I feared most. My old briefcase. The one I hadn't touched since the first time Mira called me dad. Inside, nothing. Except a spiral sketch on the inside flap, drawn in red ink. And beneath it, Phase 5, observer mode activated. I don't remember checking in. But the bracelet on my wrist said Wilton Recovery Institute in sterile, all caps print. I woke up in a room without corners. Just curved white walls and a ceiling that hummed like it was inhaling. A nurse entered. Kind eyes. Soft tone. Good morning, David. You had an episode. But you're safe now. Just rest. We'll begin recalibration therapy soon. Recalibration. There it was again. The word they loved. Like I was a malfunctioning device, not a man. I tried to speak. My voice cracked. Dry. Weak. She placed 2 fingers on my wrist. Your body's still readjusting. Don't fight the stillness. I asked for a phone. A lawyer. My daughter. They gave me oatmeal. A sketchpad. And a note that read, "You are not under arrest. You are under care." Gaslighting dressed as mercy. I spent 7 days there. Maybe more. They kept my room cold and bright. Played soft frequencies through the vents. The audio changed every day. Surrender is clarity. Truth is what you feel most consistently. The old you chose this. And over time, I started believing it. On the 8th day, a man in a tailored gray suit visited. He didn't introduce himself. Didn't smile. Just laid a thin tablet on the table and pressed play. Video footage of me, supposedly from years ago. Screaming in a courtroom. Pacing my office. Destroying a mirror. Crying alone. "I'm sorry," the man said. "We've had to contain this before. You're experiencing retrogressive imprinting. Not uncommon after daughter loss." He slid a form across the table. Voluntary Identity Mitigation Program. If I signed, I'd be reintegrated into society with diminished risk of recurrence. No questions asked. No memory preserved. I didn't sign, so they made the room colder. And every mirror in the facility started showing me a different face. Not someone else's. Just a slightly altered version of me. One that blinked too slow. Or smiled when I wasn't. Or whispered. She never existed. One night, I woke to find a nurse asleep beside my bed. In her pocket was a key card and a note. I saw what they did to my sister. "Get out while you still remember your name." I escaped at 3:47 a.m. through the laundry chute into a supply van. I didn't stop driving until I hit the state line. No ID, no money, just memory fragments and grief like glass under the skin. But I wasn't free, because when I checked my reflection in the rearview mirror, I saw her. Mira, smiling from the back seat. I turned around. Nothing, but her voice echoed through the radio. "You're still ours, David. Phase 6 is called Haunt. This isn't about power anymore. It's about what you'll do when no one believes you ever had a daughter at all." They say the mind protects itself from unbearable pain by creating stories. But what if the story itself was the pain? I live off the grid now. No name. No digital trace. A body with a heartbeat, but no proof of history. No one remembers Claire. Not my ex-wife. Not her childhood friends. Not the pediatrician who used to call us by nickname. All gone. Photos corrupted. School records never existed. Hospital files vanished from cloud backups. I even found my own will, rewritten, notarized, filed. It lists me as a childless man, a widower, with no next of kin. They didn't just delete Claire. They restructured the world, so she was never born. Every once in a while, I get a letter. No return address. Same handwriting. The last one read, "You passed the final test. You're still grieving what they told you was real. That means your blueprint remains intact." I burned it, but not before copying the ink. Because the spiral drawn on the paper? It matched the tattoo on Myra's wrist. The one I swore I'd never forget. Last week, I saw her again. Not Mira. Not Claire. Someone else. Younger. She was holding a different man's hand. Calling him Dad. Smiling with the same quiet precision. Same centered body language. Same aura of curated serenity. Another subject. Another harvest. She caught me watching. Tilted her head. Winked. And mouthed the words. "You were just the prototype. So I'm telling this story now, not to find justice. That word doesn't mean anything anymore. But to warn the next man who opens the door to his long-lost daughter. Heart aching. Hope rekindled. You'll want to believe her. You'll want it to be true. She'll say she missed you. She'll say she remembers everything. She'll even serve you saffron tea. And for a while, it'll feel like healing. But then, you'll stop recognizing your face in the mirror. Your bank accounts will drain. Your grief will sharpen into silence. And you'll realize, too late, that she was never your daughter. She was the knife. And you were just the host.